Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the public defense of doctoral candidate Chloe Fouilloux. The title of the thesis is Facing Enemies in an Ephemeral World, Tadpole Responses to Biological and Environmental Risk. The opponent is Professor Rebecca Kilner from the University of Cambridge in the UK. As the custos appointed by the faculty, I declare this public examination open.
Distinguished custos, honored opponent, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Chloe Fouilloux, and today I'm going to be telling you a bit about tadpole responses to biological and environmental risk. But before getting into the reeds of science, I would like to tell you briefly about who I am, where I'm from, and how this work came to be. The majority of my adolescence, I grew up in Minneapolis, Minnesota, which is part of a larger region known as the Twin Cities, home to about 3 million people. For those who may not know the scale of North American states, Minnesota is large enough to contain the Netherlands, Belgium, Switzerland, and Slovakia. The land of this region is characterized by extensive forests and waterways, boasting more than 10,000 lakes, which, although isn't quite a match for Finland's 180,000, the general ecology of the region is fundamental to the value Minnesotans place upon water, wildlife, and people's general relationship to the natural world. Although I grew up in a French-American household, today's lectio is dedicated to my family, who has joined us today, many of whom are based in the north of Minnesota, where less urbanized landscapes put activities such as hunting and fishing at the forefront of daily life. I'm very lucky that this group of people has instilled in me a sense of community, a love of the natural world, and a curiosity that has guided me to where I am today. However, unlike many biologists, I didn't really grow up in the woods. Luckily, Minneapolis is built around the Mississippi River, so while I never really learned how to identify plants or recognize bird calls, nature was everywhere if you knew where to look. You just had to be brave enough to swim under bridges, tromp through abandoned sewers, and climb over fences to get to the best spots. My mom was an English professor and taught creative writing, so I grew up in a world of stories and poetry, and I was lucky to have a parent that was mostly happy to have me explore the banks of the river and didn't really question how dirty I came home or what strange treasures I had found buried in the sand. And so it was growing up in this peculiar, noisy city that I learned about the natural world and felt very much like a great adventurer. I think that looking back, it becomes very easy to see the story of this journey as if it were a planned path. What are the odds that my favorite place to be, climbing behind the Minnehaha Falls, served as the perfect training ground for what would become a career in field biology? When I was 21, I took my first job as a research assistant for a three-month field season in Kaieteur Falls National Park, Guyana. While the location and scale are different, of course, the intent has always remained the same: to explore, to experience, and to understand. The top of this rocky outcrop is home to an endemic species of poison frog, which marked my first experience both working in the jungle and working with amphibians. In Guyana, I was thrown into a completely new world, embarking on a crash course in field biology. I learned about animal behavior and ecology, and most importantly, I learned about amphibians. It became apparent to me in the end that if you stay still enough for long enough, these frogs would completely forget that you were there, and you could observe them unencumbered, a front row seat into their secret world. I was completely hooked on the pursuit of understanding animal behavior, and this framed in the incredible ecology of the world that these animals exist in. On top of this, frogs don't bite, which was a big benefit for me. So, after working in other places and learning more about amphibians and animal behavior more generally, there was an opportunity sent to me about a new lab looking for a PhD student interested in fieldwork and amphibians that had plenty of opportunities to work in the Amazon and develop a wide range of potential projects. How could this be any more perfect for me? So after chatting and interviews, I moved from Morocco to the premier hotspot for tropical biology and poison frog behavior, Jyväskylä, Finland. A decision that raised a couple of eyebrows amongst my family and friends, for sure. But it turned out that Jyväskylä was the premier spot to learn about animal behavior. My doctoral work is focused around the larval stage of the dying poison frog, Dendrobates stentorius, which you will hear substantially more about today. With such a brilliant, colored, and toxic adult that are globally recognized thanks to the pet trade, my focus on tadpoles may seem a bit misguided at first glance. Many think of tadpoles as being a transient stage to adulthood, and of course, across metamorphosis, there are some fundamental steps that are investments into an individual's terrestrial future. At the risk of sounding redundant, most species transition from having gills as tadpoles to having lungs in their adult stages. In addition to completely reconstructing their respiratory system, these incredible animals gradually develop first their hind limbs and then their forearms, at which point the individual becomes a metamorph. In poison frogs, we also see an investment into the aposematic signal, which serves as a crucial anti-predator defense for the terrestrial phases of their lives. So, of course, there's a functional and important part of a young tadpole's life that is preparatory for adult stages. But a tadpole must survive through its aquatic life. They must acquire food. They must avoid predators. And this life isn't simple by any means. In poison frogs, tadpoles don't begin their lives navigating the water. Briefly, poison frog biology is a bit different than what you may be familiar with other amphibians. So frogs will lay egg clutches in the leaf litter. After a period of about 2 weeks, these eggs will hatch out into tadpoles. These tadpoles have gills, and they're on the ground, so we can already see a problem that arises here. Throughout this clade, intensive parental care has evolved, in which either the male or the female will come and carry the tadpole on their backs from this terrestrial site and bring them to an aquatic nursery where they complete development. In our species, the dying poison frog, it is the male that performs parental care. So, as I mentioned, fathers transport their tadpoles to small pools of water formed by vegetation that serve as nurseries. These nurseries can be extremely diverse, both in regards to physical and chemical parameters, meaning that the early life development of tadpoles can be quite varied depending on the nurseries their parents select. Palm bracts, tree holes, seed capsules, anything that holds water is fair game. So, while the diversity of these nurseries are vast, they are characterized by their small water volume. These limited volumes are inextricably linked to an environment being susceptible to environmental change, especially with respect to changes in temperature and changes in precipitation. The challenges associated with developing in these pools are quite easy to enumerate. These pools can dry out in a sunny afternoon, and as they are closed in relatively simple systems, the primary production and food availability for these tadpoles can vary wildly. Naturally, you might wonder what benefits these nurseries have with respect to the survival of tadpoles in comparison to ponds or lakes. And the reigning benefit of these small pools is their exclusion of larger predators, such as fish, which is hypothesized to be the selective force behind the evolution of phytotumbers. So, having established that these small pools are inherently risky based on their physical properties, it should be said that these tadpoles often don't occur alone. Tadpoles can face cannibalistic conspecifics, they can face predatory dragonfly larvae, and they can have also other amphibians that cohabit these nurseries. In addition to these community pressures, we can also consider the composition of the nursery itself with respect to the visual landscape, such as turbidity. The stability of these pools, which can evaporate, like I mentioned, over the course of a sunny afternoon, and other abiotic stressors that are present in the confines of these small pools. So quite a dynamic place to grow up, indeed. This thesis is comprised of 5 chapters that illustrate the various biological and environmental risks that have shaped the evolutionary trajectory of the dying poison frog. These 5 different stories are captured by this illustration that also double as a cover of my thesis. My first chapter, which is the circle itself, represents pool choice by parents and the kind of environment where tadpoles develop. The second and third chapters represent a closer examination of environmental states. Specifically, I consider how turbidity impacts visually oriented animals and how they navigate the world and assess risk. My fourth chapter examines inclusive fitness and recognition and how diverse evolutionary forces shape aggression in a cannibalistic species. Finally, I close with my 5th chapter, which is a broad sampling of a pathogenic fungus that has devastated diverse amphibian groups globally. To briefly provide a highlight reel of each of these chapters, if you didn't have time to read my entire thesis before this afternoon, my work begins with a deep dive into phytotum breeding species. It sets the stage for where these frogs exist, the diversity of nurseries that are utilized by different species, and the preferences these different species have evolved. I explore the role of parental care, which is extremely energetically expensive, on the decision-making and pool choice of species with diverse histories. What we find here is that most communities appear to form distinct niches that are vertically segregated. However, throughout this overview, I was able to concretely delineate that one species is uniquely flexible in their decision-making, the dying poison frog, Dendrobates tinctoris. This species flexibility makes it a fascinating model to understand parental decision-making and establishes the developmental context where these tadpoles have to survive. These species are the only one to utilize the entire vertical axis with respect to nursery use, meaning that tadpoles are potentially subject to a much larger range of chemical and physical properties compared to tadpoles of other species. Parents can climb, tadpoles are incredibly resistant to chemical changes including pH and salinity, and tadpoles seem to be able to navigate and survive harsh conditions that seem more chemically akin to the bottom of the ocean than a palm rack filled with rainwater in the middle of the Amazon. So, having established the natural diversity of options available to parents and the kinds of decisions that they make for the children, I spend the rest of my thesis exploring how tadpoles mediate the consequences of the decisions their parents have made. In chapter 2 and 3, I look at the quality of developmental environments, specifically the turbidity of nurseries, and how this affects the way that tadpoles respond to risk. In chapter 2, I generate several hypotheses considering what may be the outcome of developing in turbid environments. I propose possible proximate changes in tadpole physiology, such as spectral fine-tuning in tadpole retina, to compensate for a redshifted turbid environment. In addition to these physiological changes in the visual system, I also propose changes in phenotype, such as the loss or relaxation of color in species with warning signals. In my third chapter, I had the chance to apply some of these hypotheses that I developed in my second chapter in an empirical context. Here, I replicated an experiment for two different phytotum breeding species to examine the effect of rearing environment turbidity on tadpole response to diverse visual stimuli. I established that indeed, poison frogs are visually oriented animals, which is a notable finding as the functionality of vision in larval stages has been a topic of debate within the community. In this work, I show that not only are tadpoles using their eyes, but they are flexible organs capable of adjusting to their environment. I find that the turbidity of rearing environments affects the way that tadpoles respond to visual stimuli, and for the dying poison frog specifically in the context of this brief lecture, that developing in turbid environments appears to relax predator responses in novel contexts. The results demonstrate that visual landscapes of developmental environments can shape behavior, which surely has effects on a tadpole's feeding and survival. Together, this has cascading effects on the trophic interactions and ultimately community structures contained within these environments. So, as a cannibalistic species that can share small, ephemeral, and food-limited spaces, this system really lends itself to asking questions about kin recognition and aggression. It is quite exciting for me to think about the basis of aggression in young animals because they don't hold territories, they're not competing for mates, and they don't have the hormone levels traditionally associated with extreme intraspecific aggression. How do the benefits of a nutritive cannibalistic meal weigh against the cost of eating a family member? In this study, I manipulated both size and relatedness between tadpole pairs to see how the physical and genetic components predicted aggression in the dying poison frog. Here I do find that tadpoles are able to discriminate kin, and this plays a role in mediating aggression, but family ties are never enough to protect a smaller tadpole from being attacked if size differences are large enough. I close my thesis with a project that is full of potential. In a nutshell, it explores the presence of a deadly pathogen that has been the root of extinction and widespread population declines of diverse amphibians globally. This pathogen, colloquially called BD, attaches to keratin, which unfortunately for frogs compromises the entire skin of adults, and for tadpoles consists of their mouth parts. The pathogenicity of this fungus ultimately disrupts osmoregulation in adults in their skin, which leads to heart failure, and in tadpoles decomposes their mouth parts, which leads to indirect death by starvation. One specific lineage known as BD-GPL, which is the global panzotic lineage, is, as the name suggests, globally distributed here in green. Out of the evolved strains, it is one of the most virulent and the cause of mass population declines in the neotropics, Europe and Australia, and the focus of our work in this context. So, across more than 2 years of sampling adults, tadpoles, and the nurseries where these tadpoles occur, the conclusions from these efforts are far from complete. However, it goes without saying that these samples illustrate the importance of understanding disease dynamics in the context of a host's natural history and represent an enormous effort in the pursuit of understanding a pathogenic agent responsible for the largest loss of biodiversity in the modern era. Before jumping in to what is sure to be a thorough and exciting examination of my scientific work, I would like to close my lectio with a brief poem analysis in honor of my mother. In the first pages of my thesis, marked with a yellow flag for those that have a physical copy, you will find the 51st section of Walt Whitman's famous poem, Song of Myself, which upon many rereadings, I've concluded accurately captures life from the perspective of an ephemeral pool looking outwards into the world. I will read the first three stanzas, and hopefully the impact of this creative work on my own will become evident throughout the course of this defense. The past and present world, I have filled them, emptied them, and proceeded to fill my next fold of the future. In this first stanza, the filling and emptying across time can be understood to be the dynamic nature of these pools and the inherent instability of being a water-filled vegetal structure. Listener up there, what have you to confide to me? Look in my face while I snuff the sidle of evening. Talk honestly, no one else hears you, and I stay only a minute longer. In the second stanza, we are directly addressed by the Phytotigmata that invites us to investigate their very nature, to do so honestly, and to attempt to understand the ephemeral world they contain. Do I contradict myself? Very well then, I contradict myself. I am large, I contain multitudes. Finally, in the course of many bouts of frustration, we find that sure, sometimes biology contradicts itself. In the grand scheme of things, perhaps contradictions aren't so surprising or even contradictory, as the natural world is vast and contains multitudes. Honored Professor Kilner, as the opponent appointed by the faculty, please present the comments that you see my dissertation has given grounds for.
Distinguished Kostos, honoured candidate, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. It's a great honour to be here and to take part in the examination of this thesis, so thank you very much for inviting me. And just like Chloe, I think I should spend a little time introducing myself. So I've spent more than 25 years studying parental care in other animals and more than 15 years being a parent myself. And in fact, I'm visiting Finland with my family right now. But nevertheless, I've learned a great deal from reading this thesis describing the amazing behaviour of these frogs. And in fact, I've been so inspired by their remarkable behaviour that I've left my husband in charge of my children, and he's transported them to a nearby lake. And hopefully they're staying somewhere a good deal safer than the world encountered by many of these tadpoles. Now, like Chloe, the reason I study parental behaviour is because I'm interested in the link between evolution and behaviour. And parental behaviour gives us insights into this connection that are not easily made by studying other types of behaviour. And one of the reasons I enjoyed reading this thesis so much is because it encourages new ways of thinking about parental care. And so I'm going to spend some time explaining to you my view of how Chloe's results fit into the wider field of research on this specific behaviour. But I also think that Chloe's work contributes to fresh ways of thinking generally about the connection between evolution and animal behaviour. And so I'll end by explaining exactly how it does that. Now, the reason why Chloe's work is so interesting is because she cleverly chose a species with a fascinating life history and, crucially, an understudied way of looking after offspring. So in most work about parental care in animals, we're used to thinking of parents as protectors and providers, as largely benevolent individuals whose job it is to protect their young from the harsh realities of the wider world. And perhaps some of this is wishful thinking. In many ways, it's what we tell ourselves good parenting looks like in our own species. But this way of thinking applies to one of the frog species that Chloe studied, Ufaga camilio, shown here, where females, as Chloe described, lay each of their eggs in a different pool to which they return at intervals to nourish their offspring with eggs that they add to the water. So here the mothers are buffering their offspring against starvation, and they're protecting them against predators because they can afford to lay their offspring in pools that are relatively deprived and poor of life, including predators. So mothers are keeping their young fed and safe, even though their nursery is somewhat remote from the mother most of the time. Now, these diligent acts of parental care are usually contrasted with the many species of invertebrates, and a few vertebrates, it has to be said, which provide no post-hatching care at all. And so offspring have to go it alone from birth. And so that's well illustrated here by this barnacle species, where there's a huge spawning event going on. The parents are releasing their gametes into the water, and that's the last their offspring will ever see of their parents after fertilisation. They have to go it alone. Now, the interesting thing about the main species that Chloe studied, Dendrobatis femoralis, is that it doesn't neatly fall into either of these two categories. It definitely provides some care, but it's not the full-on set of behaviours that we see in other species that endure throughout offspring development. These parents are not full-time protectors and providers. And that's because the frog fathers in this species abandon their offspring in a pool when they're only halfway through development. So it's much less like the middle-class ideal of parenthood, in which we all bend over backwards to raise our offspring to be their best selves, and much more like the kind of parental care that's favoured by the British aristocracy, who like to dump their children in a boarding school when they're halfway through development. For these frogs, their last act of parental care is the choice of pool for their offspring. And from that point onwards, the tadpoles are left to fend for themselves and to feed themselves, effectively taking on responsibilities during their own development that we more typically imagine to belong to the parent. And so I think this offers us a new general way to think about parental care, because we should stop thinking of it solely as a transaction between devotedly altruistic parents and dependent offspring, and instead we should think of it a bit more as lying on a spectrum, reflecting a variable division of labour between parents and their young, where the labour is the nourishment and defence of offspring during offspring development. So at one end of this spectrum here, we have some birds and mammals, where it's the parents that take on the lion's share of this responsibility in feeding and protecting offspring. But at the other end of the spectrum, we have a case like this mayfly here, where there's no parental care at all, and it's the offspring that take on all of those responsibilities. But really, what Chloe's work shows is that it's here, in the middle, where the interesting territory lies, and where Chloe has located the research that she describes in her thesis. Because here, the division of labour is much more equitable. And the interesting question for future work, I think, is to identify the ecological conditions that cause parents to land in this central zone on the spectrum when they evolve parental care. And I think it will also be interesting to see how the position on the spectrum is changed by pathogens, just like BD. Does it push them towards being more towards parental care, where parents are taking on more of the responsibility, or away from care, where offspring are taking on more of the responsibilities? Now, to understand the other general insights gained from Chloe's work, we need to go back to the 1930s to look again at how the relationship between evolution and behaviour is analysed, and how our understanding of parental care first took shape. Now, the 1930s is when the field of ethology, so that's the scientific study of animal behaviour in nature, it's when it first started to take shape. And it was also a time of great expansion in evolutionary thinking. And these different approaches generated quite different ways of analysing the connection between evolution and behaviour. So the way that we think now about the relationship between animal behaviour and evolution was set out by the fathers of ethology. So they're shown here in increasing order of beardiness. So on the left here we have Nico Tinbergen, and in the middle we have Konrad Lorenz. And they were exceptional naturalists. They were keen on finding a purpose for the behaviours that they observed in nature, and their work was inspired by Darwin. Now, when Lorenz turned 60, Tinbergen wrote a paper in his honour that defined the field of ethology. And in that paper, Tinbergen set out two research questions for thinking specifically about the connection between evolution and behaviour. So his questions ask, how is behaviour adaptive, and what's the evolutionary history of that behaviour? And so they place the animal's actions at the end of an evolutionary sequence, and they see them as the adaptive outcome of evolution under natural selection. And by setting out these two questions, Tinbergen laid the foundations of the subfield of behavioural ecology. And this is the field of research that has analysed in greatest detail exactly how parental care is adaptive. So for more than 50 years now, researchers in behavioural ecology have analysed how parental care is adaptive by weighing up the fitness benefits that animals gain by supplying care for their young against the fitness costs that they incur when they carry out all that hard work. And the key assumption is that natural selection is an optimising agent. So it favours the parents that get the most fitness gains for the least fitness costs. And decades of theoretical analyses and careful work in the field have shown that this assumption is true. Animals can certainly bump up their reproductive success by looking after their young, and it turns out that they suffer a small fitness cost by doing that because it reduces their chance of breeding successfully again in the future. Now, in many instances, the fitness costs and benefits associated with the behaviour are also dependent on what everyone else is up to. And that's especially true when there is competition for resources. Sometimes the payoffs are greater if everyone conforms and performs the same behaviour. Sometimes they're greater if you deviate and do something different to everyone else. And the best behavioural strategy is then frequency dependent, and it's the one that yields the most fitness benefits given what everyone else is up to. So these different ideas mean that behavioural ecologists think about parental care by focusing on these three big questions. How is care adaptive? What is the optimal level of care? And do the payoffs depend on the behaviour of others? And Chloe's work makes new contributions to this traditional approach to studying parental care by providing new answers to these questions. So, for example, she identifies novel costs and benefits associated with the supply of care. In Chapter 1, she shows in detail how important it is for males to decide which pool to lay the tadpoles in by finding that pools differ in their quality and some are clearly better than others. And the best pool is the one that optimally balances the nutritional benefits that the tadpole can gain against the hazards that it will face while living in it. In Chapter 5, Chloe finds plausible evidence of a new cost of care, with the possibility that fathers are transmitting BD to their offspring when they transport them. And in Chapter 4, Chloe identifies a new context in which payoffs from behaviour depend on what everyone else is up to in her investigation of how tadpoles regulate their cannibalistic behaviour. So this is the second key way in which Chloe's research findings are significant, because they identify new costs and benefits associated with care and new ways in which the payoffs from social interactions among siblings can be frequency dependent. Now, although behavioural ecology dominates our understanding of the evolution of care, it has some obvious drawbacks in its approach. some of which are evident on reading the kind of natural history discoveries that Chloe has made. Because these discoveries can't really be shoehorned into the traditional way of thinking about parental care. So the weaknesses are identified here. The approach of behavioural ecology focuses on stable outcomes rather than dynamic processes. It tends to ignore ecological effects of behaviour, and it tends to ignore downstream evolutionary consequences. And so this brings us to the third major insight from Chloe's work, which is that we need a different approach, I think, to analysing the connection between behaviour and evolution to overcome some of the problems posed by the behavioural ecology approach. And this involves returning to a neglected way of thinking about the connection between evolution and behaviour that was first spelled out by G.G. Simpson back in the 1950s. So while Tinbergen and Lorenz were busy in Europe establishing the field of ethology, over in the States, George Simpson was asking his own questions about evolution and behaviour. And Simpson is famous for being one of the architects of the modern synthesis, the fertile period of evolutionary thought in the 1930s and 40s that blended genetical analyses of variation and inheritance with Darwinian ideas about natural selection and adaptation. And Simpson was also a paleontologist. He liked his fossils. But by the 1950s, he had successfully introduced ideas from the modern synthesis into paleontology, and now he turned his sights on doing the same for animal behaviour. Now, as a paleontologist, Simpson took a long view of evolution, so he positioned behaviour in the middle of an evolutionary sequence rather than at the end, as Tinbergen and Lorenz had done. So he asks, how does behaviour evolve? But then, how does it determine the subsequent course of evolution? And we can call the second part Simpson's question in his honour. So Tinbergen and Lorenz, and now the field of behavioural ecology, think about behaviour as the outcome of adaptive evolution, whereas Simpson thinks about behaviour as dynamically contributing to further evolutionary change. And what that means in practice is that here we have an outline of the evolutionary process in which ecological conditions impose selection on variation that's inherited to bring about trait change through genetic change. And Simpson sees behaviour as influencing these key steps in the evolutionary process. And I think what Chloe has done really well in her thesis, in my view, is to identify these links with some of her work. So chapter one shows how parental behaviour changes the ecological conditions that tadpoles encounter when parents choose the pools of water that their offspring will occupy. Chapters 2 and 3 show very nicely how this has downstream consequences for the tadpole, because the ecological conditions chosen by the parents impose selection that influences the tadpole's perception and response to risk. And there's even a hint of a possibility that pool choice in one generation could influence pool choice in the next generation, introducing phenotypic variation that could be inherited non-genetically. Is it possible, for example, that small frogs with poor climbing skills only have access to inferior pools, which means that their offspring will be small and have access to inferior pools? The key point here is that these are not discoveries or predictions that are easily derived from the traditional behavioural ecology way of thinking about parental care. And in the discoveries that Chloe has made, she's introducing a new way of thinking about care, one that allows more easily for dynamic evolutionary change and considers the importance of ecological conditions and also builds in potentially specific mechanisms of inheritance. And this approach still allows us to think about the adaptive value of a trait, not by focusing on the trait itself, but by focusing on an agent of selection. And so that means we can understand the work in chapter 4 as the outcome of selection by tadpoles themselves on each other's behaviours. Now, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with the traditional behavioural ecology approach to understanding the evolution of parental care, but the more we understand the natural history of parental care through detailed studies like Chloe's, the more we can see the limitations of this approach. So in summary, I think that Chloe's thesis is a remarkable contribution to knowledge in its own right, and it makes valuable conceptual points of its own, which Chloe has already summarised really well. But in the broader scheme of things, I think Chloe's work is even more important because it asks questions that cannot easily be accommodated by conventional behavioural ecology. And Chloe's discoveries are significant at this very general level because they will help shape new ways of thinking about the connection between behaviour and evolution. Right, I'm just getting my questions up. Excuse me. So I thought we might begin with a bit of a general discussion about how you chose your thesis topic. And I'm really interested to know, I think you started to explain to us a little bit already, why you chose to study frogs and not, to pick a completely random example, burying beetles.
Yeah, so I started passionate about marine biology. And throughout my course at university, I was able to find and be invited to Guyana to study frogs, and they have an aquatic stage, and I thought, well, close enough. And so then when I first worked from frogs, really, it was this insight into being able to see the way an animal behaves unencumbered, which really was just mystifying for me. I felt like I was a tree just secretly watching the world, and that was really, really exciting for me. I didn't want to get pigeonholed and to being a herpetologist, so I tried to go work with macaque monkeys in Morocco, and that was a terrible life decision. No, they're nice, but they're not as nice as frogs. And so then decided to return to my amphibian origins.
And was there something about their natural history in particular that drew you to the science questions that you're interested in?
Well, I think that, I mean, first of all, metamorphosis is quite an amazing feat. Yeah. Complete restructuring of an animal's physiology, and it's still the same individual, is completely fascinating. But what really got me into Bibiana's work and the work I was doing previously with red-eyed tree frogs is care, and that these animals perform care, and we think of them as perhaps simple hopping machines, but these things can be quite profound in the way that they move and assess the world.
Great. Okay. So if we think about your extraordinary thesis as a whole, which chapter are you most proud of and why?
I feel a lot of emotions about different chapters.
Yeah.
But I would say chapter 3 in general. We briefly discussed this, but it was the first chapter that was my idea from the origin. And we were able to not only make that idea a reality, it was entertained by my amazing supervision community, and we decided to put it in action. I was able to travel and do it and analyze it and write it and publish it, and that was really quite a great experience. I'd say that's my favorite chapter.
Excellent. And which of the findings that you made was the one that you least expected?
I would say that actually this chapter 3, I typically, most of this thesis is based around the dying poison frog, but in this third chapter I was able to take a comparative approach with another species of poison frog that does food alimentation, the Ufaga pimilio. And it was really interesting to see the way that, even though these are both vital tum breeding species, the way that they assess risk and how they navigate the world, let's say visually, for lack of a broad term, was completely different. And I couldn't believe it, because I thought, they're tadpoles in pools of water, how different can they be? But really, the natural history of both of these species shapes the way that they navigate the world tremendously, even though they're doing so independently later in life.
Right. So let's just think a bit more about the frog's natural history then. You've got this interesting observation at the start of your thesis where you describe Dendrobates tinctorius is a voiceless frog, and also say that it's uniquely flexible in its habitat use.
Mm.
And I wondered whether you think those two things could be causally related.
So the fact that that this poison frog doesn't call is very strange. The fact that it also has clear aposematic qualities to it, you would think maybe this is playing a part into it, but that's not really the fact, because many other poison frogs are brightly colored and vocalize a lot. And so their habitat flexibility with respect to them not calling, I guess I'd never thought about that. I wonder if really the reason, well, the reason, their voicelessness has evolved. I mean, we can think about this from a lot of things, but it is true that their flexibility in terms of habitat use is quite different compared to other species.
Are they territorial?
It's hard. I mean, loosely, perhaps. It hasn't really been established yet. It seems that they tend to repeatedly occur in the same places over a small period of time. But to say that they're doing aggressive defense like we see in some other animal species isn't really what we're seeing. But I think if we did more drawn-out observations, we might be able to establish some kind of loose territoriality.
I wondered whether their great flexibility might mean they're not territorial, and so that could account for their voicelessness.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's funny, I've always thought about this great flexibility in terms of parental decision-making.
Yeah.
Because really when they tend to climb up trees, they're transporting a tadpole. And so it could be that they're... Because sometimes they visit pools before they transport their tadpoles, and our hypothesis was, okay, they're kind of checking out the availability of options before making a decision. I think the space that they occupy is so large, the distances they cover are so vast, that to say that this is territoriality wouldn't be correct. And so I think that kind of goes hand in hand to your point of, maybe this voicelessness and this lack of territoriality could be linked, because there's not much to defend in the sense of the original
they're quite nomadic.
Spot that they're defending. That's a very good point.
And then turning to the kind of acts of care themselves, did the males always transport one tadpole at a time?
So for the vast majority of times, yes. Let's say, 60, 70%. Sometimes I've seen a dad transporting two, once three, but it's really quite rare. And I'm not sure who's controlling that interaction. And that is something I've really wanted to know. Is it the tadpoles that are fighting to get be the first one to get the shuttle to the water?
Yeah.
Or is it the dad that's exerting some top-down control?
Yeah.
No clue.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
And do you think that has any knock-on consequences on clutch size?
Yeah, the fact that this species actually... I think dendrobatids, in comparison to many other amphibian types, produce very small clutch sizes. So intensive care, and also the mom is not overproducing, let's say. However, I would say that the survival rate of tadpoles, once they're laid to even this 2 weeks to tadpolehood, it's actually quite low, because we've got drying, we've got predation, we've got plenty of fungi that are growing. So I would say, if I'm making a hypothesis about optimizing clutch size, that the females, I guess arguably, I would say perhaps overproduce almost, because to produce four or five and only one or two actually make it anywhere is still quite a bit of energetic investment.
Okay. And then can you tell us what happens? So I kind of imagine there's this kind of clutch of eggs. Dad goes off to take one. What happens when he's off? They just sit there by themselves.
They sit waiting
and dying.
The
females nowhere to be seen.
Yeah.
Okay.
They are just... And that's really why I think we can ask questions in the future that are really interesting about the order of who gets on first.
Exactly, yeah.
But really, while they're just slowly suffocating. it's what's fascinating is that these transportation events can last 2 days. And
oh
so you have
God.
A dad transporting this tadpole for 2 days while the rest of his clutch is potentially drying out.
Amazing. So, and then how long are they in the pool for once they get there?
Depends on who's around, what kind of food there is. I'd say around 2 months. So it's not a short process by any means. It could go even longer if they're, malnourished and they don't get the resources they require.
Wow. So one thing I was very surprised in reading the thesis, you have this kind of throwaway section about how you're able to identify individuals because they've all got these very unique aposematic markings. Mm-hmm. And that sort of flies in, doesn't that fly in the face a bit of theories about aposematism that are all supposed to be terribly convergent because they collectively educate a predator about how nasty they taste? So aren't the predators going to be terribly confused if they all look a little bit different? And how does that fit into that thinking?
So if I think about the role of, I wouldn't say it's, of course, not pattern recognition, but I'd say the colors themselves and the pigments themselves are so striking,
okay,
especially in this population, that can serve as the learning cue and the deterrent.
Yes, I see.
But also it should be said that the population that I've studied is in a what is presumed to be a hybrid zone. So tinctorius are spread across the entire Guyanese shield, and they have kind of different colors and different morphs throughout their population range. And so associated with that are different levels of toxicity as well. But I think it's, I would venture to say that it's really less about the pattern being replicable itself and more about the strength color. of the signal.
Cool, okay. And then finally, you've got this comparative study, quite different kinds of care going on. We've got mothers feeding offspring with eggs that they bring, fathers chucking their tadpoles into a pool and leaving them alone. Is anything known about the ecological conditions that kind of switched the evolutionary pathway through egg provisioning versus tadpole carrying?
So from my understanding and memory, oophagy evolved after. So these pamelio are evolved after tinctorius did. So what I believe is the case is that through flexible, broad phytotum use, like we see in Dendrobates tinctorius, then we can see more selective, even more extreme environments. So the environments that these strawberry poison frogs, the Ufago pamelio, choose are the leaf axils of bromeliads, which are, I would say mostly tinctorius stay away from them because they're so, so small in volume. They're less than a volume of a shot glass. And so in choosing that even extreme, even more extreme breeding environment and nursery environment, the pressure to have some kind of food there then kind of is cyclically related to females then provisioning food throughout development because there's really nothing there.
Okay. So should we move on and talk about the detail of some of your, well, all of your chapters? Let's start with the first one, conventionally. So chapter one, this is the one where you did a huge survey of lots of different kinds of pools and how what quality they were and so on. So the first thing I wondered, and this kind of comes, we'll come back to this, I think, in one of the later chapters, is you measured about 4 million things. One thing you didn't measure, as far as I can see, is how variable the background colouring is in the pools. But that's one of the parameters you measure, you manipulate in one of your later chapters. So could you just say a little bit about that? What's the kind of variation that we see in background coloration in pools?
Enormous. Of course, these species are using anything from live trees to tree holes. And I think the idea of this background coloring and this visual environment, these luminic conditions, are really something that came later in my thesis and wasn't even in my sphere of thought, really, at that point. We do think about canopy cover, which was kind of the amount of light that's allowed in. I didn't measure that directly, and we didn't, but we had talks about it, and so it was in the frames of discussion. But at that point when this was published, the light availability and the light quality of these rearing environments wasn't something I was thinking about quite yet.
Mm-hmm. And would you say naturally the extremes are greater than or the same as or different to the extremes in your experimental manipulation?
Definitely less. I mean, in my experimental conditions, I'm using crystalline white and pitch black. So, of course, they're abstractions of reality.
Yeah.
So, the range in the natural world is much, much lower. Well, not much lower, but notably, it's not crystalline white or pure black. But I think that this variation in the world that these tadpoles are navigating in nature is extremely
There's still
dynamic.
Some there. Yeah. Okay, fair enough. All right, so let's move on a bit. So you say at one point, which came first, parental pool choice or larval specializations? So I wondered, are they really independent of each other? And to what extent do you think the larval, and we talked a bit about this myself just recently, to what extent do the larval specializations persist into adulthood and affect the scope for pool choice in adulthood?
Yeah, I think, so there's a chapter that never made it to this final final thesis, which is about the effect of diet then on the carryover effect of not only the aposematic signal of larva, but also kind of their size at metamorphosis, their time to metamorphosis, things like that. And I think that this cyclical nature that you brought up of evolution informing behavior and behavior informing evolution, what I've seen and what I've observed is that, for example, tadpoles that have experienced crowded environments, which potentially is associated with attacks from other tadpoles and other predators, then seem to be more weary of risky visual cues. We had a great idea to look at this across metamorphosis. Unfortunately, COVID stopped the experiment, so we couldn't quite follow those tadpoles through to their froglet hood. But I think there's plenty of literature and vast studies of this kind of inheritance of predator avoidance and perhaps even being able to, the responsiveness, the effect size of the response. So I would definitely predict that these tadpoles that are developing in these crowded nurseries are then coming out less bold as adults, and that is a trait that can be inherited later in throughout the generations and passed on.
And so would you say that could account for some of the variation in size between species as well? How much of the variation do you think is accounted for by developmental conditions versus
in tadpole size or in adult size?
I was thinking about that slide where you have all the adults of different sizes. So adults rather than tadpole.
Of course, tadpoles that are existing in more stressful conditions coming out smaller is what I would predict would happen. In comparison to other species, just like species-wise adult size, the effect of if we look at the evolutionary trajectories of these different frogs, to have the size of a toad in comparison to a poison frog, I think it's much more than just their larval conditions that are shaping that. Of course, there's a lot more at hand there. I'm sorry, maybe I lost the question.
No, you're on the right lines. I don't think I asked the question particularly precisely.
Yeah.
I guess I'm kind of interested in the extent of variation within species in size could be caused developmentally, and the extent of variation across species in size, and what you think, whether you think the two could be connected or whether that's just a coincidence.
Let me start with within species so I keep my... So within the species, the variation in size, we've got both, of course, these genetic effects that, like I mentioned, across Guyana, we've got different populations of these Dendrobates tinctorius frogs, and they're all the same species, but their morphology changes quite dramatically. So we're in what is hypothesized to be a hybrid zone, but there's populations that are almost double the size of our frogs and others that are half the size. In addition to these physiological differences, we see behavioral differences of some being much more in the leaf litter and some being much bolder and out there. So I would say to that extent, you could maybe say, I think the larval life is driving some of these changes, but I think that in the grand scheme of evolutionary theater, there's many other things that are selecting and forming these populations. Okay. Across species, like I mentioned, I think then their specializations, especially in this chapter of, being fully arboreal or fully terrestrial is also going to be playing a role on why they're different sizes and things like that. Yeah.
Excellent. So one of the things I've often wondered is how do fathers keep track of potential sites where they could lay?
Yeah.
And with the mother that lays her eggs rather than takes tadpoles, how does she know where to go and remember where to go back to provision? Is anything known about any of that?
So there's been a lot of tracking work done with Dendrobates tinctorius and other poison frogs related, and their ability to navigate and remember and return to home is quite impressive. There's been tons of translocation experiments, so taking a frog outside of its territory 500 meters more and then seeing, can it return home? And there's another species of poison frog, Alabates femoralis, which is even just, they're like a dart going back to where you place them. It's amazing the way they orient themselves. There were thoughts about how they do this, which are very much kind of in the process of being understood. There were some ideas about magnetic orientation and things like that, which I think needs some more refining, and we're not sure about that line yet. But really, there this ability of having this mental map, let's just be coarse about it, and returning to these pools is really... I have no idea.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, these are tiny little frogs, and they're not just navigating in 2D. They're navigating in 3D.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's something that has also kind of been neglected when we think about, you know, territory size or even spatial ecology, is that these frogs are moving in 3 dimensions. And that's really important, because the energy it takes to climb up this tree is not neglectable.
Yeah. So I guess I was just thinking about from the dad's point of view. Does he like go and check out all the possible sites where he could lay and then get a tadpole and take them to his favourite one? Or is he just kind of... got the tadpole on board, then starts checking. I mean, what's the sequence of events there?
So it seems, I mean, we've seen, like I've mentioned, adults in pools, and they're frequently males, without tadpoles. And the pool has no tadpole, the male's there. So the thought is, and we don't see females doing this so often, so the thought is, well, they're not going there to, you know, hydrate themselves. They're doing some kind of reconnaissance of the area. So there's that thought. And also... I would say that there's some premeditated parental care, that they have some kind of mental map, and also fathers tend to revisit pools that they've and reuse pools they've already used.
Right.
And when we think about, at least from different species, we see that frogs move significantly farther to a pool that's significantly farther from their territory than the closest pool. So they're not just using the closest drop-off point.
No.
So that's in all of that. I don't mean to anthropomorphize and say intentional, but at least premeditated, or there's some kind of bias or some kind of trend that is shaping this pool use that's non-random.
Yeah, so and that really kind of gets to the heart of the key question I had about this chapter, actually, because, I mean, throughout, I don't think this is unreasonable, but throughout all you're assuming that you talk about pool choice.
Right.
And I'm just wondering, how do you know they're making a choice? What would the distribution of tadpoles look like if it was just random opportunism,
right,
and they just kind of dump a tadpole at the first pool they find, or the first pool they find that's not horribly infested with some hideous thing that's going to eat their offspring or whatever?
I think that, I mean, if this was following a random distribution, I could walk a transect down the forest and look at X amount of pools and expect to see a tadpole every X or Y or Z meters. And that's not what we see. We see clumping around predictable... But of course, their range that they use is quite fascinating, but there are limitations in the sense that when we are walking and seeing these pools with a pH that's quite acidic, that is also covaries with a bunch of other interesting parameters. There are no tadpoles there, you know? And then we've also done follow-up experiments with another group, actually kind of trying to investigate this pool choice, because there was this idea between having a shallow and wide pool versus a narrow and deep pool. So kind of testing the idea of desiccation potential. And there was also manipulations with occupation. And the data are still kind of being refined, but it looks at least that the occupation of a pool is a great predictor for future depositions in that pool.
Okay.
So it's interesting that I think there's a novelty effect, of course, when a pool is first created. But then if you have a developed tadpole that's already there, that's already made it, let's say halfway through development, that ends up being a very strong signal to predicting where dads are going to put their tadpoles next, because they see, oh,
it's not already, that he's run out of ideas.
This one's already survived long enough in this one. Maybe this pool is stable. Of course, that comes with the trade-off of being placed in a pool with a giant cannibal.
Yes, exactly.
Which is problematic.
Yes, and we'll come on to that in a minute, actually. So so it's not just that he's run out of other options, and so...
No, I would really say that's not my... With the distance we've known them to travel... And the kinds of decisions they make and the novelty of pools that they invade when you provide them, I'd say that it's not just... Yeah, I would say that choice is a word that I stand by.
Okay. And then one final thought on that. I suppose when you find a tadpole in a pool, it's a sign that the pool's quite good because the tadpole's still alive, right? Is it possible that there are a whole load of pools which are rubbish, and the tadpoles died, so you never get to record the decision made by the dad?
That's completely possible, of course. I would like to think, well, first of all, the decomposition of the tadpole body.
Right, you'd see a corpse floating in the water.
It happens quite quickly, but okay. If they die and you're quick enough, I mean, you can see, like, oh, that's, oops. But also, I don't know, I really, it's quite, when you put a pristine pool out, pristine, you know, it's got the water, it's got the placement, it's nice and deep, I mean, really. And of course, I mean, through previous work through Dr. Rojas, we see that with these tree falls and this creation of a bunch of new breeding spaces that are of this high quality, novel place. I mean, they just flock to them, like, intensely. So,
right. Yeah. So you're painting this picture of these super intelligent frogs that have absolute perfect monitoring of their wide world and exactly where the best place is to put their offspring, and they get it right every time. So is that right? Is that how you think? So you don't see that there's any deviation from perfection?
Yeah. Parents make mistakes.
Oh, yeah.
I think that perhaps my appreciation, as you've mentioned, of this species and their feats that they perform, at least with parental care, come from a space of just being able to see all of the other options and seeing that they're avoiding those options. So, of course, I mean...
As far as you know.
Yeah, as far as I know, yeah. Right. I mean, no parent is infallible, and of course, tadpoles get eaten and tadpoles die. And I think that it would be really interesting to see across populations, you know, how these different pools... How pool choice changes between populations, how clutch size, I know even between populations, clutch size can be different as well. And so in populations that perhaps have larger clutches, are they even less discerning with where they put their tadpoles? Of course. Mm. And of course, I mean, at a lot of the times, a dad is placing a small tadpole with a large cannibal. And that's not ever really a good decision to make, because the end is pretty much guaranteed there. Mm-hmm. So definitely not, yeah, maybe I need to tone it down on how cool these guys are.
Not at all. I just wondered if could you accept there might be some variation that's due to the dad's own experience? So one interesting question is, how does he get his perception of what a perfect pool looks like? Mm. To what extent is it informed by his own experience as a tadpole? Although he was obviously experiencing the water from a very different perspective. Is there any scope for variation that could be explained by what the dad experienced as a tadpole?
Hmm.
Which would mean that across a population, you wouldn't necessarily see every individual favouring exactly the same kind of pool.
I think that that's a really... I think the variation that we see in deposition strategies, even within tinctorius, are sometimes puzzling. You know... I think that the larval experience of being transferred then to a parent's choices is something that's really logical that I need to think more about, because my thought, at least how I would think of things, is less. That is less that approach, and more that dads and my advisors are not exactly happy with this perception, but I'll say it anyway. That across a clutch, a father is playing a bit of a game of chance, in the sense that what if he is distributing his tadpoles? One goes to a super crowded pool, one goes to a more accessible pool, and how does this change across the transport line? That's the one potential side, but the other potential side, of course, is that he has a larval experience or previous, even adult experience, previous clutches and seeing the survival of those tadpoles, and then that informs and shapes his decision later.
Okay. All right, shall we stop talking about this chapter and move on to the next one?
If you wish.
So this is your setting out of ideas about how the developmental environment could influence tadpole sensory systems.
Yeah.
So could you just give us a bit more background, I think, than is available in the chapter about typically how long development takes? So we've got some idea of the sort of time scale that we're focusing on.
Yeah, so from the time that they're placed in the pool, I'd give them about 2 months before. It could be let's just say generally 2 months before completing development, having their tail absorbed and hopping out of the pool if everything was well.
Yeah, okay. And do you think that the duration of the development can influence whether or not the environment's going to affect the tadpole sensory system?
So I would ask it the other way.
Okay.
In the sense that it's not the duration of development that could affect if the environment affects the tadpole development system, but if the environment is stable or variable enough to affect the development of a tadpole sensory system.
Okay, interesting.
Because I think one thing that we have to acknowledge about this is that these environments are variable. I mean, they're inherently ephemeral. And so, you know, are these, you know, some developmental pools are more stable than others, some are, you know, could refill and dry out and the water can change and all these things can change. So I think it's less about the developmental time, because if we think about, this isn't, you know, opsin shifts. If we think about just this vitamin A1, A2 shift, that happens quite quickly. That can happen within a week.
Okay.
So that's really not,
okay.
The development time there, for me, is not the question. The question is more the environment itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I understand better now. I think we should move on to the next chapter. So I had a few questions about the experiments here and your results. So is it D. tinctorius is the one that's vulnerable to attack by predators, right, compared with O. pimelio?
Beg your pardon?
It's Dendrobates tinctorius that's vulnerable to attack, is that right, by predators?
All the tadpoles are
More than Euphaga pimelio?
I wouldn't say that one is more or less. I would just say that one is attacked by aquatic predators and one by terrestrial predators.
Right. So if we're comparing the aquatic predators, mm-hmm. Do you know anything about the relative strike rate of attack by, say, dragonflies versus conspecifics?
The rate in, you know, I wouldn't be able to define any kind of, you know, the frequency with which that happens when they interact. But I can say that in the field you can see them eating tadpoles.
Okay.
But no, I don't know, maybe strike rate, perhaps I'm not understanding the question.
Well, I just wonder which is the greater threat to the existence of the tadpole. Is it one of their own or is it a dragonfly larva?
Yes. Okay. I think that is really determined, is totally based on both the size of the dragonfly larva, which needs to be big enough to attack a tadpole, and then the size of the opposing conspecifics, which need to be large enough to attack a tadpole. So
okay.
In that sense, I mean, if, and then you have to wonder also about the food level within the pool.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So do you know anything about the relative importance of those two predators in the natal pools that you drew your experimental subjects from?
So in the pools that I drew my subjects from, they, at least in we varied the, well, we varied. We found tadpoles that came from pools that varied in their density,
mm-hmm.
For the tinctorius, counts of tadpoles that were in that pool, and some of them also had additional predators like these Odonata larvae within them. What we found in that sense, of course, some tadpoles are developing in these crowded pools and some are not. And so, of course, those that are developing in the crowded pools have a larger potential of being cannibalized or eaten or predated.
Is there a readout of that on their body? Can you see evidence that they've been attacked and survived?
So, not always, but you can definitely see bruising on the tadpole body or even parts of its tail that kind of get knocked off. You have like a perfect little mouth bite that's happened there. So, and like I mentioned before, we didn't go so into this in the discussion, but we do see, if we are in our table one... the table one, that on page 6 of this paper, you see that the conspecific count, so how many other tadpoles were in that pool, affects the space use of our focal tadpole. And so we didn't want to get too hand-wavy and say, oh, you know, just because... So the thought was, okay, if they developed with more conspecifics in this novel context, they're being more less bold than those that haven't. Of course, to say that, you have to kind of do a couple more experiments in between, but the thought there is that this developmental context in a novel context is still influencing the way that they're responding to this visual risk.
For whatever reason. Yeah.
Be it perhaps this developmental experience of being attacked or seeing conspecifics being attacked.
Yeah, or maybe they all just move around a lot and don't get attacked at all.
Maybe, yeah. So.
Okay. How does, you know, there's a bit of work done on the signalling between, in Ufago Pumilio, when the tadpoles receive eggs from their mum,
yeah.
They do a little bit of a wiggle themselves, don't they?
Yeah.
So does that have any influence at all? Is that kind of indicative of greater activity because that's how they get fed? That's independent from the kinds of correlates that you're looking for.
So what's really interesting is that there's this ritualized begging behavior that this tadpole does, which is very clear vibrating motion. And so that wasn't something... So actually, in this Costa Rica experiment, we had time to put not only spiders and conspecifics, but we also put moms in the center to see what would happen.
Okay.
And there was no vibrating behavior elicited in these tadpoles in this experimental context. So really the swimming here...
is completely different.
...is swimming. And that begging ritual that is so famous is...
Yeah.
Apach.
Yeah. Okay, that's great. All right, let's move on to cannibalism in chapter 4. So one big question I had here was about what's the typical relatedness of tadpoles... You kind of allude to it at one point. You say it's in process that you're trying to find out. What's the latest on that?
Hot off the tail clip analysis. It seems that they are extremely unrelated in the wild. That within pools, the relatedness within pools is very low.
Okay.
That is puzzling and does not help with our idea that fathers are perhaps, you know, making these risky decisions, but placing them with a related individual that provides some kind of protection. It seems, at least from our analyses, that these individuals are not related at all, which does not, I mean, that just continues the questions.
Mm.
Yeah.
So do you think it's possible that if a father was to put a much, we talked about this a bit earlier, put a much smaller sibling in with a larger one, he has no intention whatsoever of that sibling, smaller sibling, actually surviving. He's just feeding his older offspring. Because that would explain also why you don't see them coexisting very frequently, because they've got eaten.
I think that is a really good hypothesis, and I think that's been put forward in previous work and has been kind of the driving dogma. However, I think also... if we think of it from the parent perspective of the energy they're spending carrying that tadpole, when a pool can have other sources of nutrition, let's say other heterospecific tadpoles, perhaps some kind of, you know, other vegetal matter, and also the now that we're farther down the road, the nutritive benefit of an actual cannibalistic meal, which is actually something I question. Now,
there's
anyway,
no benefit.
Is it more than a different heterospecific tadpole or other available resources? So I think that when these mistakes happen or these counterintuitive deposition strategies happen, perhaps there is some function. Again, I think it could be a game of chance in the sense there's some function of it potentially just being eaten, but why would he, again, put a tadpole in a pool with an unrelated tadpole?
Because that one's not intended to be a meal.
Right.
So I'm just wondering whether, because he's this amazing machine that can remember everywhere that he's gone in his life and where he's deposited his previous offspring. He could be making, if we assume that's true, an adaptive decision about putting one of his own alongside a bigger sibling that's already there to help that sibling out.
Yeah, but since we see them, well, at least based on these analyses, that they're with an unrelated...
Because they've gone.
But when we see both of them there...
Oh, I see.
I think then the the value of the larger tadpole being an indicator of pool stability is really the driving force, in the sense that that larger tadpole can die, can be predated by a snake or a bird or something else. And I think that also, I mean, these smaller tadpoles, they're pretty nimble. I mean, they can swim pretty fast, they can hide, and if there's alternate food sources, it might be worth the risk.
Okay. I think it would be really interesting to compare this frog biology with the species of birds where there's obligate siblicide.
Yeah.
So there's no intention that, that one of the siblings is ever going to live.
Mm-hmm.
The parents make it anyway. They invest a lot in it. They make the egg, they incubate it, they feed it for a bit, and then it dies every single time.
Mm-hmm.
How does that compare as a kind of scale of investment with the kind of scale of investment argument that you're making for why this can't be happening in in the frogs? I think, I mean, so you've got a range of different hypotheses here.
Yeah.
I think it'd be very cool to set them all against each other and see if there's any way that you could test to distinguish which is true.
The reason why, of course this food hypothesis is possible and would be really fun, but also we've got pools that are occupied by sometimes more than 40 tadpoles.
Okay.
And tadpoles successfully, you know, reach metamorphosis.
So that's a very different dynamic to the bird situation, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Let's move on. We've asked some of these, discussed some of these points already. What's the typical interval? So I was wondering about the half-sibling possibility.
Yeah.
What's the typical interval between clutches?
So fathers and mothers can be can have multiple clutches at once.
Oh, wow.
So the turnaround time is completely overlapping, and they breed year-round.
Right. Okay.
So there can, the possibility of half-siblings is completely within biological reality.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And do you have an explanation, a mechanistic explanation, or maybe an evolutionary explanation for why it is that they can distinguish siblings but not half-siblings?
So my thought is, and I say, I think this is one of the big limitations of being, or at least the approach that I take, you know, we're seeing the end result. And that kind of negates, perhaps they are recognizing them, but then just decide not to, not to behave in a way that we expect. And so it could be that they can recognize half siblings and then just are not behaving. And they say, well, half sibling, all right, tasty. but that's, again, it's really too, I mean, not too bad, but it's definitely a limitation that we have in the sense that they might be, but I'm just not able to see it.
But the behavioral, that you, the behavior that you're measuring to test whether it's true might not be
doesn't
the one.
Doesn't reveal it.
Yeah.
Which, in that sense, I suppose, if we're going from a more ultimate, you know, approach, in the end, it's the behaviors that they actually express that are,
you know. Yeah.
So I think from a mechanistic perspective, they could be. And there's also other, I'd say it's multimodal in the way that they're identifying conspecifics, I think, not only via odor, but also potentially via taste. So I think there's a lot of inputs there that we could explore to see if they are able to distinguish these half-siblings. I mean, like we see in, what's it, spadefoot toads, I believe, that they're able to discriminate, you know, first cousins. So I think there's like an evolutionary reasoning for that to be able to happen. But from a mechanistic point of view, it's not something I've been able to explore, but I think it's something that could be done.
Okay, great. So let's move quickly to chapter five then. So the first question, so pseudo-vertical transmission.
Yes.
What's the difference between that and vertical transmission? This was new to me.
Yes. So vertical transmission is a transmission of a pathogen through any, through pretty much in utero. It has to be like directly from the parent to the offspring in utero, so within the parent.
Oh, right.
And so pseudo-vertical is then any product from the parent that has been created but is not within.
Oh.
So that can be milk from a mother, that can be
goo
from a dad.
I've been using this term wrong for years. and why is it, do you think, that the males carry more of the BD zoospores than the females?
Why?
Yeah.
I think because they're the ones that are visiting more pools. So they're the ones that are in these, they're going out into the wilds and at least having these opportunities to interact with possible places where zoospores could occur, and also the males, the females just in general might just behaviorally just be less. Also, when we think about combat and like fighting between males, there's a lot more touching there.
Okay.
And so perhaps spreading of zoospores in that way. Though females fight as well, so yeah.
Okay. So you rule out tadpole-to-tadpole transmission?
Yes.
Let's imagine that that's possible, hypothetically.
Okay.
If it took a while, could that account for variation in infectious status within the pool? Because that's how you eliminate that explanation. But if it's happening but takes a while,
yeah.
It could be possible you've got an infected tadpole that hasn't yet got around to infecting the other tadpoles in the pool. Is that possible?
The only thing is that the life stage and the infectious stage of a zoospore is about 24 hours.
Oh, okay. So, it's
so
very quick.
Because it's so quick...
Okay, fine.
That was our...
Excellent. That rules out that explanation. and I had one more question on this. Where is it? Oh, yes. Did you find... have you got any direct evidence that tadpoles transported by the same infected male to different pools are... No, okay. That's too difficult to get, I guess.
I don't think that in the wild it's something that we're going to be... that we found. I think it's something that could be found, but I think that these are the kinds of questions that need to be asked in controlled environment in the lab. I think that would be the best way to see if that can happen in real life.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't have any further questions.
After this, I solicit those people who have any critical comments regarding my thesis to ask for an address from the Custos.
Do you give your statement before?
Don't say my statement.
Yes. To say that it was good. You need to give your statement.
Okay, fine. So this is my concluding statement. I want to make some comments generally about the thesis before wrapping up. So I think this is an excellent body of work, which would be remarkable at the best of times, but which is all the more amazing because you've completed it in the very difficult circumstances of a global pandemic. It elegantly combines fieldwork, experiments, and modelling with two big literature syntheses. And as I said at the start, you have asked new questions about parental care with this system that cannot be easily accommodated in more conventional approaches. You've made remarkable natural history discoveries, some of which can be applied immediately to managing the threat posed to amphibians by the BD chytrid fungus. You've obviously done the majority of this work yourself, and it represents a significant contribution to knowledge. And therefore, in my statement to the faculty, I will be recommending that the dissertation of Chloe Fuyu be accepted as part of her qualification for the degree of Doctor of Philosophy.
So if any questions further arise, please ask an address from the Custos.
If there are no questions, the public examination has been concluded. I would like to invite you all to the reception that is taking place outside the lecture hall.